My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is a German podcast about contemporary music and mindset. But once in a while I do some episodes in English. I have studied classical singing, but I love singing contemporary music a lot. If you want to meet me or experience me in one of my concerts, please go to my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this in the show notes for you. And also on this website, you can apply for my newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes and topics all around new music. I share with you behind the stage knowledge, insider knowledge, and I want you to bring closer the human beings out of the new music world. I'm very thankful for all your feedbacks and comments, and also very thankful that you tell your friends and colleagues about my podcast. Today, I have an interview for you with the composer and ensemble and festival director, Gwyn Pritchard. We met at the Trinity Leyburn College in London. This beautiful college is right at the Thames. And we were in a practice room recording this interview for you. And I think you might hear sometimes the other musicians practicing. But I thought it adds a very nice atmosphere being surrounded by music and by musician. Hello, Gwyn Pritchard. We're sitting here now in a practice room at Trinity Leyburn Conservatory of Music and Dance. So yeah, we're here right in the music and the art world. And I say welcome.
Very pleased to be with you this evening.
My first question for you is, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, very specifically, on one occasion when I was 16 years old, I went to a summer school to where I thought I was going to be playing Mozart string quartets on the cello and that kind of thing. And there was a concert at which Massian was performed. I'd never heard anything like it before. It was the Quartet for the End of Time. And although I don't remain a huge Massian enthusiast to this day, I, at that time, was deeply struck with it and completely changed the sort of music I was trying to write. I have to say, what I was trying to write at that stage was pretty basic, but it's opened up a pathway, an avenue for me. I think, interestingly enough, when I was a student, I studied the cello, not composition, initially. It was at a very conservatoire, at a very conservative establishment. And any contemporary music was viewed with great suspicion. I was asked for Xenakis for the college library and was told this is a music college. But that was 1960-something. And I think partly in reaction against it, I was determined to wave the banner for contemporary music and got very interested in people like Boulez and so on at the time. That set me on a course which has continued through my life.
And when did you start composing?
Well, I started composing when I was 12, but there were little melodies and pastiche piano pieces and things. A couple of them are rather beautiful, actually. I'm sometimes thinking, well, I wish I could write as like that right now. No, that's, I'm being facetious. I started writing seriously when I was a student. There's a couple of those pieces that I wrote then are still performed. And then I went through a process of fairly rigorous self-teaching and analysis in my early to middle 20s. When I really spent all day analysing works by contemporary composers, people like young Burt Whistle at the time, for example. And that really gave me the foundation of my work as a composer ever since that period.
What represents good new music for you?
Oh, that's a billion-dollar question, isn't it? I have a very personal take on this, which is, I certainly like and believe in and aspire to write music where there is some kind of internal structure, organization, something that holds it together. I'm not saying it's got to be immediately accessible to analysis. I don't mean in that sense. I don't want the banality of something which wears its structure on the surface. But music which is there, so that if someone were to find it in 1,000 years' time, they would identify there is something going on in it which will give that piece its musical reality. And that's, in essence, what I believe in as the basis for good music, generally.
And what are the qualities you most appreciate in performers you work with?
Honesty. Quite simply that. I need players who, and I work a lot with performers, I have my own ensemble and so on, and they're terrific. Sometimes they're very honest with me and tell me when I'm not doing what they need me to do as a conductor. But no, more seriously, I like players who are seriously committed to what they do, who are not doing it for the job, who are outstandingly good, I mean really seriously outstandingly good, world-class players, but who are not in any sense pretentious about it, who are committed to it and are dedicated to the process of making music.
You know, I'm a singer, so I'm always like to ask...
Well, you're one of those, by the way.
Thank you. I often hear that for some composers it is difficult to write for the human voice. How it is for you, and what is special or challenging about it?
Well, it's very special for me because my wife's a singer and I absolutely love the voice and the repertoire. I'm also deeply critical of it. There are probably 70% of voices I can't stand. For example, I can't stand voices with very heavy, wide vibrato. Going right outside the sphere of contemporary music, when you listen to a lot of Wagnerian sopranos, I find the sound utterly intolerable. But then you hear someone like Kirsten Flagstad from many years ago, who sang Wagner with just as much power, but without a massive vibrato, and you realise how much more beautiful it is. This is a subjective response, of course. I don't like unnecessary theatricisation, which many singers bring to music. In some sense, the voice is just another instrument, although, of course, it's something else as well. But for me, it's certainly something. I've not written a great deal for the voice, I should add. Not very much at all, but what I have written and what I would like to write, and hope I still will, would be very much informed by my love of the voice and my interest in it.
Does it help you that your wife is a singer?
Oh, it's helped me a lot in the past, yes. Yes, it's helped me a lot. And also I used to accompany her. I'm not a great pianist, let me say, but I was a good enough one to accompany her on a number of occasions. And working together and all the issues that come with working with... And as a pianist, you're inevitably, to some extent, coaching a singer, even if you're not a singer yourself. And coaching is perhaps not the right word, but certainly there's that kind of contribution you make, which is different from when you're working with an instrumentalist. And that makes me climb inside the voice and the vocal mechanism. I can feel what's going on physically with the singer when I'm playing the piano for them.
And if there are students who want to compose for voice, is there any advice you would give them?
Yeah, I would advise them to listen to a lot of singers, and not just to the music, to the actual singing. I'd advise them to work with singers always, but that's true of any instrumentalist as well, but perhaps particularly true of two things. One are instruments like the harp or something, which have got very specific technical limitations and demands, and the other is the human voice, because I mean, the range between any two sopranos is probably vastly greater than between any two violinists.
That's
You've got
true.
To know what you're working with.
How do your friends, family, colleagues and the audience react to the sort of music you make, and how do you deal with their reactions?
Well, that's two or three different categories, isn't it? My friends, many of them don't hear it, quite simply, so they don't react. I've got many friends who are not musical. But of those that are in the musical world, by and large, they don't say a great deal, in the sense that I think musicians very often don't evaluate each other. They don't take their own subjective response is not something they want to offer to another musician. There are some notable exceptions to that. I've had people come up and say they don't know why I've done what I've done, and I've had other people come up and say they absolutely love it. But by and large, there's a kind of mutual respect. You're doing your job, I'm doing mine, and we talk about other things, maybe other composers, not each other. So that takes care of the musicians. As to my family, I have one daughter who is a very well-established composer who lives in Norway. And actually, I don't talk about my music much with her either, or her music. Same thing applies. Although there is, I will sometimes ask her, and I always get a very honest reply if I do.
Do you think there are prejudices against new music? And if so, how do you want to see things change? And what are you doing to bring a change in the attitudes?
Well, prejudice, of course, literally means to judge in advance. I think it's not so much prejudice, it's sheer ignorance of contemporary music. I think the sad reality is that what composers and performers of contemporary music now do is so far removed from what most people think of as the musical world around them, which is mostly, of course, commercial and popular music, popular culture. It's such a different world, they're not even aware of it. And the number of times I'm asked by people, what sort of music do you write? And my answer has to be probably a sort of music you don't even know exists. Although, of course, I wouldn't put it that way, but that's what it comes down to. So yes, therefore, as soon as they hear it, there is inevitably some sort of prejudice, because the understandably spontaneous reaction is to compare what they're hearing with the sort of music they're familiar with. Or you say, well, I write contemporary classical music. And they go, classical music, is that like André Rieu or something? Mm-hmm. Which I have to say, no, it's absolutely not. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. But that's something that needs more than explanation. It needs experience. And you know, most people out there are simply not experienced. What can we do about it? We need massive funding support. It's an interesting, if I can just take a little story here. I was in Basel in Switzerland one year, and there was a Sunday morning concert when a very difficult piece of mine for three percussion, electronics and piano was to be performed together with a couple of other pieces. Sunday morning coffee concert, and I thought, who is going to come to hear this sort of music on a Sunday morning in the Stadttheater in Basel? To my surprise, a substantial audience gathered, and I'm talking about hundreds. And I was bowled over, and I said to my colleagues there, where have all these people come from? And they said, well, these concerts have been running for many, many, many decades. And Paul Zacher, the famous supporter, sponsor of music, had originally promoted them and funded them. And you'll notice that a lot of people come with their children to these concerts. That's because they were brought by their parents 20 years ago, and even one generation further back than that, perhaps. So it really worked. Just the constant support, admittedly, probably many of the people there went there because it was a sort of cool place to be on a Sunday morning. But nonetheless, the contemporary music as a culture was thriving there in a way it certainly doesn't here in London, which is a city 50 times bigger.
That sounds great with Basel.
It was.
You're the founder of the London Ear Festival in London, and you started it in 2013. What was your motivation to start this festival, and what is unique about this festival?
Well, motivation, it was a strange situation. I have a very good friend called Andrea Cavallari, an Italian composer, and I won't go into great detail, but it turned out that, well, just at the point I met him, that he actually had a house in the same town as I have a house in Italy, as well as having a place in London where I was living at the time as well. And he also ran an ensemble, and I have my ensemble, so we said we should get together and just do a couple of concerts. And then we thought, well, maybe we'll get a pianist friend in and have a mini festival of three concerts. 18 months later, we were running a festival of 12 concerts with international performers coming from all over the place. And we've been doing that ever since. Not every year, I hasten to add. It's sort of biennial. But the real motivation was that both of us felt that we lived in a world where the kind of music that we took seriously was not getting enough exposure, just picking up on the last point you asked me about. And we needed to create an opportunity where the audience could come and experience complex contemporary music. We make absolutely no concessions. We don't perform the kind of contemporary music that does get performed in London, which is mostly, which gets performed regularly, which is kind of minimalism and perhaps the more kind of fashionable end, as far as there is a fashionable end of contemporary music. So we decided not to touch that repertoire at all. And there was absolutely nothing else in London by way of a regular contemporary music festival. Since then, a couple of other things have got going. And we persisted in what you might call late modernism, music which has followed the kind of modernist tradition. So composers like Lachenmann, Sciarrino were getting included in our programmes. I just picked two names out of a hat there. We had a very large number. But also, I've always been interested in internationalism. I'm very worried that Britain is becoming far too insular in its attitudes again, far too provincial, far too inward-looking. I'm not talking about Brexit here, but about purely culturally. And there was a time that Britain was appallingly narrow and provincial back in the pre-war years and the early years after the war in the 1950s. It then suddenly became a major international player in the musical scene, and we had people like Maxwell Davis and Burt Whistle and lots of others who were widely respected around the world. Since then, it seems to have closed a lot again, and I was concerned that we kept the spirit of internationalism, international exchange, international repertoire alive, so the festival was an opportunity to do that.
And do you have a certain approach for the audience?
Yes, very definitely. The festival is not big, I have to say. It's quite small. That's to say, we have two venues we use, one of which seats about 120 or something, the other about 70. And the one that seats 70 is also a festival club. And the club is a major meeting point. We have pre-concert talks in there. We sell CDs in there. We have late-night concerts and lunchtime concerts in there. So it gains a very intimate feeling. Clearly, we're not talking about concerts with hundreds and hundreds of people, and we don't have any orchestral concerts. We actually, one year, did the London Sinfonietta was performing, and we used a much larger venue for that one. But they were involved in the promotion of that concert, so that was something rather different. But by and large, it's intimacy.
So the audience appreciates it a lot that they get so close to the performers.
They come back, yes. And we've had questionnaires which we give to people, and people are absolutely amazed by it. They absolutely love it. We have a string of very positive responses.
Awesome.
Yes.
What is your approach to time management? Do you have any rituals? And is there any advice you would like to give us?
Listen, I'm the last person in the world to advise anybody about time management. I spend my life chasing my own tail, trying to get things done, wishing I'd finished one thing before starting the next. I crash through life as best I can. I don't manage time. It manages me badly.
And do you compose every day?
No. I wish I could. No, it's out of the question with various other commitments. Teaching here, for one thing. Yeah. I now live out of London and have to commute in, so I'm teaching here. I have festival when I'm programming. It needs a lot of attention. Not to mention the normal burden of administrative domestic duties, which everybody has. I have tried going through periods when I do at least a little bit of composing every day, but it's generally speaking just not possible. Other times I compose every day and don't do anything else. I mean, last summer was a case in point where I worked obsessively on a number of pieces and everything else got behind, but at least I got the pieces done.
What are you thankful for today?
What am I thankful for? I'm just thankful that I have the creative energy that I have. I don't know where it comes from. I'm very thankful that I work with many of the musicians that I do, that I have the performances. I've been very lucky in the number of performances I've had in recent months and years. That's not a huge number, but it's certainly enough to keep me on musically on the move in every sense, physically as well as artistically. But basically, yes, I'm just very, very thankful that I still have that sense of burning, I was going to say ambition, it's not ambition, it's inquiry. It's wanting to know what I can do if I try doing something, what follows. I always feel when I start a piece of music, if I know what I'm going to write before I start, I've failed. I need to know where to start and not know where I'm going to end up. I like the idea of that ambiguity being built into the whole creative process.
Who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Oh dear, that's a very tricky one. The greatest role, do you mean purely musically? Or?
You can answer it any way you like.
I mean, undoubtedly my family has been a huge artistic influence on me, not because we sat and talked about artistic matters, but because I feel that the internal life that I lead within myself is profoundly influenced by the emotions that are driven by my love of my family, which means a great deal to me. And I don't mean that sentimentally in any sense at all. In terms of purely musical influences, I think I've never had a favourite composer. I've had favourite pieces or pieces that I admire particularly, pieces that inspire me, but the same composer may write other pieces that don't. So it's very hard to answer that specifically. What was the rest of your question?
Yeah, who has played the greatest role in shaping you and what inspires you?
What inspires me is never one single thing. I'm inspired to write a piece, any individual piece, by some idea, like for example, something to do with the passage of time, or something to do with suppressed energy, or the release of energy, or some conceptual thing of that sort, which I then try to turn into, via techniques, into a tangible musical process. And that's where my kind of inspiration comes from. It just comes from within my head. Now, that might be triggered by something really small. I give you a case in point. I've always, and I don't know why, been fascinated by the sight of disused railway lines running through the landscape with grass overgrowing them and so on. That sense of the linear, the rigid, set against the organic, it affects me. It moves me. It really does affect me, actually. I'm quite obsessed with it, that kind of thing. Traces of things. And that's something that I would frequently try to... Well, I don't even try. I find it drives me in a musical sense, inspires me.
What does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in the music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
I think the first thing is to have no expectations of other people's response. Last year, I've had quite a lot of performance of my music. Next year, I may have none. I'm not going to let that idea... I mean, I don't think it will be none as it happens, but it could be, theoretically, anyway. And even if I thought it was very probable that I would no longer have the opportunities that I have now to have my music performed, I would feel it's extremely important to me to keep working. That sort of musical integrity comes from commitment to my ideas, and to the possibilities, creatively, of the ideas that are spinning around in my head, rather than trying to court success.
And what does success mean to you?
Writing a piece which, at the end of the day, I think, I never knew I could have written that.
What drives you forward? Do you have a vision?
Just the things I've just said. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Then we arrived at the last question, which is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Well, it's probably the same thing yet again, isn't it? It's kind of it sounds a bit of a cliche, but be true to yourself. Challenge yourself. Don't be put off by imperfection. Imperfection's a terrific thing when we are faced with some evidently incomplete situation. Then there's something to work on, something to apply yourself to, something to explore. Above all, explore. That's what I would, and I do, I have been doing today when I've been teaching composition here at the Conservatoire. It's exactly the point I try to push.
Well, thank you very much for answering all my questions today, and I see you around.
Thank you very much for asking them. It's been a great pleasure.
I hope that this interview inspired you. I'm looking forward to your ideas and suggestions through email or Facebook. Thank you that you're here with me. I hope that you liked it and it inspired you. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.